Startups Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Poehler. Each week, we talk to founders who are building their businesses outside of Silicon Valley in the so-called flyover states. This week, I'm joined with Ryan Battles of Harpoon. We talk about Harpoon, running a web studio, and his new book, SaaS Marketing Essentials. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Pat. It's a real honor. And my background is that I'm born and raised in the Midwest, the classic flyover state of Ohio. Born and raised in Ohio, and I started my career off as a teacher. I taught high school students computer classes, anything from like how to take apart a computer and put it back together to making web pages. And the thing that really got me excited and pumped was making web pages. And so I started doing that as a business, and I ended up, I liked it so much that I ended up quitting my job at the school. And that also came around the time that we got pregnant with our twins. So I was kind of half stay-at-home dad, half web developer there for a while, and kind of went from building up an agency to working for another company, and now I'm out on my own building SaaS products.
Wow. So when you started your web studio, it was Jovia.
Correct, yeah. Jovia Web Studio.
That's a lot to kind of juggle early on. You have kind of new kids, new family, and now your income has gone from a steady teacher's pay, to hunt what you eat.
Right.
what was that adjustment process like?
Well, it wasn't as bad as you would think, and I think part of that is because I was at a small Christian school, so the income there. Actually, one of the reasons I had to quit is that I couldn't afford a daycare for two children off of the salary I was making there at that school.
Oh, wow.
So, it's kind of one of those things that people who take that position, aren't really in it for the money. So, it didn't really take long for me to land a few gigs that, would amount to that and then eventually surpass that income that I was making. But, it was kind of – the decision was made for me to leave that job and then come home. And my wife was in a residency training program at the time, so she couldn't stop to help take care of the kids. I mean, she had a little bit of time off. But so I ended up being the one that stays home. And even though we had two kids, they were like our only children. And babies, they tend to sleep a lot. So I had plenty of time during the naps that they would take and late nights and stuff too, to build out some websites for clients. So it wasn't as stressful. In fact, we weren't even counting on me having that much income from the clients, but it just ended up happening that I was able to land a few, nice gigs right off the bat that I was able to knock out during nap time. So the studio, Jovia, kind of just started itself and made sense, the more I went along with it.
How did you land those early clients? How did you get yourself out there and market yourself?
Yeah. So as a teacher, one of the things that I would do is I'd go to the conferences that teachers would have. So there's in Ohio, we have this thing called the eTech Conference for Educational Technology. And I would always submit proposals to go speak at that conference, mostly because they would then pay for a hotel for me, and I'd get an excuse to
I love that about conferences.
Right. I just wanted to have.
If you ever
a couple
want to go
days.
To a conference, be a speaker.
Exactly. Yeah, I just wanted a couple of days away from my job and get the hotel room paid for. So, a couple of the people who were in the audience of some of the talks, they'd come up and talk to me afterwards. And one of them eventually called me and said, "Hey, our district is looking to redo our intranet, like their interior pages." And she started listing off all these features. And at the time, I didn't really know how to use any content management system. I was still building things with HTML and CSS pages, like one after another. I didn't even use any includes or anything. So I was looking at Expression Engine's list of features, and I was basically just telling them, we can do this, this, and this, because I'm reading that it can be done. So therefore, now I just have to figure out how to do it. So I kind of bit off more than I could chew and was trusting in the documents. And, you know, on one hand, I don't recommend that approach. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, start before you're ready is also a good mantra. So I dove in and ended up completing the project, and it was great. And then that led to a few other referrals. So that's how I got started.
Wow, that's great. And you ran Jovia for, what was it, 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years. Our last client was, I actually had closed down the studio, but one of my former clients contacted me, and they were like, you know, are you still doing this? And you know, they've always been good to me. So I'm like, well, you know, maybe. And they're like, well, we have this project with Google for the Democratic National Convention. And oh, wow. So I was like, I'm all ears. Keep going. You know, just the opportunity to work with Google and to see like what their processes are and the projects that they have. And then just knowing that, you know, something that I'm building, what it ended up being was the software that powered the Trinitron that was like in the conference center. They had just done it successfully with the Republican National Convention. And this was then for the Democratic one. And this was in the election year where Obama was just reelected. So, they ended up using that same technology for the presidential debates, like on the Trinitron screen behind the president candidate. So it was pretty cool to know that something I had worked on was being used in that way.
That's incredible. Did you have any second thoughts when that came up of like, well, I shut down the studio and, you know, I'm after 4 years, I've got to a point where, you know, Google is knocking on my door. were there any, we'll talk about going into CrushPath, but was that a moment where you were like, oh, I don't know if I'm making the right decision here to go back to a full-time position?
No. Well, so it kind of ties in with CrushPath. So yeah, I closed down my studio at the time that I accepted the job with CrushPath, and CrushPath is a, startup out of San Francisco. They're, a venture-backed, startup. And, so I was contacted by a friend of mine, Andy Johnson, who's also my business partner in a few things. He started working with them, and he was giving me some like hourly contract work with them. And then he's like, you know, Ryan, we really want you to come join the team. And then they started selling me on it. They started selling me on the board of advisors and who is involved with this company and what analysts are saying of the future of the company. And it started making sense to me, and our like founders were featured in Inc. magazine. So it's like, I'm thinking, all right, if I can come on as like, you know, one of the first 10 employees to this startup that looks like it's really going places. I mean, one of our advisors was Phil Lieben from Evernote and Aaron Levy from Box. So, you know, a few of these big names in Silicon Valley, I was like, you know, I do all right for myself with Jovia, but I'm kind of limited to just, you know, picking up hourly work here and there. And it was great, but you know, I was hoping that, you know, hey, maybe this will be the thing that where they're like, oh yeah, you know, the early employees are all driving Lamborghinis, you know, like, So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot. And, I also knew that if it didn't work out, you know, because statistically most startups don't, that I could always go back to starting up Jovia again. I mean, it's just a matter of calling in a few friends, see if they have any overflow work, and starting to pick up clients from there. So It wasn't that scary. I made the plunge into CrushPath then.
So you worked at CrushPath for 2 years as a lead engineer. During that time at CrushPath, what, you know, you kind of saw behind the looking glass of like a San Francisco, you know, classic, you know, venture-backed startup. What were some of the positive things and negative things that you saw while you were working there?
Yeah. It was interesting to see behind the veil there, because I had always assumed that, like, you know, these guys are out of my league. Like, the people developing with these companies, the type of personality it takes to be a founder to work with these companies, you know, it's like, I'm not in San Francisco. I'll never fit in. But one of the great surprises of working with those guys is that I realized, you know what, they're humans just like us, and they're not any different from a guy from the Midwest. I mean, they just happen to have access to cooler coffee shops. But, you know, they, and, you know, more people out there are doing things and talking about things that are exciting to people like me. But at the same time, it's like you can step up and do good work and have a successful company, even though you're not out in the valley. So just like lifting that veil for me was monumental and pretty instrumental too, and just giving me the confidence to start my own products, even though, you know, we're not venture backed or we're not out in the valley. You know, that we can do it here, bootstrapping from Columbus, Ohio. So
after 2 years of CrushPath, you left CrushPath to start, start working on your own products. What led to the decision to leave, after 2 years? And, was it just, you got the entrepreneurial itch again, that CrushPath wasn't scratching, or, you know, what were some of the factors that led to you leaving?
Yeah, well, I think it was just, you know, a variety of things that I just had that feeling, you know, inside that I was ready to move on to something else. I mean, it was a hard decision. I definitely enjoyed everybody that I was working with there and the founders. You know, it was a great place to work, and I left on very good terms. And in fact, I still contract with them. Even now, I have a monthly contract with them. So, you know, I have a great relationship with them. But yeah, I just felt like it was time for me to move on and scratch the itch of being more of an entrepreneur and marketer. Because at the time, I was a developer. So my day-to-day role was mostly, you know, marking things up and pushing commits. And doing that for 2 years was great. But, I wasn't seeing myself exercising those entrepreneurial muscles that I kept reading articles and listening to podcasts, and I just wanted to get out there and do it myself, you know? So,
yeah,
that's it.
So you joined up again with Andy, your longtime conspirator.
Yeah.
and you guys started Harpoon.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Harpoon is and what problem it's trying to solve?
Yeah. Actually, so when I was running Jovia, I was in a co-working space here in Columbus that Andy Johnson, my co-founder of Harpoon, was also working out of. So we had, even though we had separate businesses, I was running Jovia, he was running Shaping the Page, is the name of his business. But our desks were butted up against each other. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we were, you know, about as close as two workers are. And we frequently took, you know, walks around the park. There was this nice little park out back, you know, at like the 2 p.m, not feeling like you're getting anything done. Let's go take a quick walk. Yeah. Or, you know, someone's on the phone with a client and they get all frustrated and they're just like, oh, I just need to take a walk. You know, the other one would grab the jacket and we'd go out and, you know, just bring some sanity to the workday. So Andy and I got to be good friends there, and we decided to start working on a few side projects. And one of those was Harpoon, and that came out of a frustration that we had with our current solution that we were using for invoicing our clients. That tool was great at, you know, sending out invoices, and the clients could pay, and you know, it's as far as the transactions go, it was great, but it never really gave us a nice overview of how healthy our business was. It never integrated with any kind of yearly goals and how we're tracking towards those. I mean, we had to do all that stuff in a spreadsheet separate to our invoicing tool. So we thought, you know, we can develop. Let's try to make this dream app that helps us as freelancers to set a goal. And even though we're still invoicing our clients with this tool, like when it brings in that money, it starts to show us like, here's how you're doing for the year. You know, you're ahead of schedule or you're behind schedule. And so then we started just building in some fun widgets like, you know, like how many days of vacation have you earned? You know, if you're ahead of schedule, we look at about how much you make per day. And then we divide that and we're like, looks like you could take about 10 days off and still hit your goal. So just fun little things like that we built into it. And, yeah, so that was the vision behind Harpoon and where it's heading.
And I think that's a fantastic, it's a fantastic app. I've used it myself, and just being able to see, it's very hard to get day to day some kind of a good temperature, I guess, of, you know, am I doing as well as I think I'm doing? or
right,
or you know, am I, you know, it's usually like, I guess when you're working for yourself, there's always this, you always feel like there's something chasing you down, and the instant you stop, you're going to get, you know, overtaken by it.
Yeah.
And I think Harpoon, like, at least the biggest pain point I see is that it, you know, it can remind you to just say, hey, actually, you can slow down for a little bit. You can actually just enjoy a nice cup of coffee at a coffee shop without having to really, you know, work, or
right, right.
You can go and have dinner with your wife or your husband or your, you know, your spouse.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I, so I think one of the coolest things that, you know, I work at a co-working space too called the Salt Mines. And so how you met Andy and how this friendship happened that turned into a business, you know, relationship, I think is a really strong, you know, antidote for the power of, even if you're working for yourself, you know, you need to collaborate with other people, at times and just go out there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been invaluable. You know, I'm currently back to working out of my basement for the time being. And a lot of that just has to do with family schedule stuff. I can get more done without a commute. So, I see the difference, you know, like being in isolation, it's got its pros and cons, you know, like the positive of working at home is that there aren't those distractions, because I'm a social guy. So, you know, when I go into co-working space, the first half hour, I'm chatting about, you know, what was on TV last night, or, you know, the weather, who knows, you know, whereas, you know, at home, not only did I kill the commute, but I killed all the small talk as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's invaluable to have those relationships too. And I think they need to be offline, you know, somehow. So, yeah, Andy and I also have a meetup that we have around town called Bootstrap and Beer that, every other month or so we get together with people that are bootstrapping their own products just to, you know, get to know each other, bounce ideas off, and, you know, make some face-to-face interaction. I think that's, it cannot be replaced in today's day and age, especially with people working in such isolation.
Yeah, I agree. So you worked on Harpoon and you've gained some experience, I guess, in marketing Harpoon and marketing some of your other products, Find Bacon, Director E. It seems like there's also another application I'm forgetting at the moment.
Share the Shelf. Like
Share the Shelf, yes. There's so many of them, it's hard for me to keep track. But you do, you're kind of like me, and you try everything. You know, if it seems like if you have an idea, you go for it and you experiment on it. So you decided, I think we had talked about this last year at some point, you told me you wanted to write a book.
Yeah.
And you launched that book, and congratulations to that. And it's SaaS Marketing Essentials. How did you get the inspiration for the book? And tell me a little bit more about the process of putting that together.
Yeah. We just actually launched last week. So it's a very fresh project in my mind. So yeah, SaaS Marketing Essentials, this grew out of understanding that the way to really learn something and learn it well is to do it or to teach it, you know, either one of those two, versus just reading about it or hearing about it. So what I wanted to do is, I knew that I had to grow Harpoon's user base. I knew I needed to know a lot about SaaS marketing. So what I did was, in all the articles that I was researching and podcasts I was listening to, I was just taking copious notes and, you know, who's doing what and what lessons are they learning, and getting all those notes collected and then regurgitating them out into blog posts, and then eventually regurgitating them into chapters of a book. I had written an outline of the table of contents of what I thought a SaaS marketing book should include. And that basically steps through, you know, defining your audience, getting to know your audience, and reaching out to them effectively and having growth and traction within that audience and finding product market fit, things like that. So those are the subjects that I knew I had to research, and I would research them way better if I knew that I was going to turn around and write about them. So the book is basically a compilation of things that I've learned and then tried with Harpoon and then kind of recording the results. So it's a little bit of my own experience, a little bit of the experience of others. But yeah, so finally wrapped that up and got some pretty decent interviews to go along with it with some other marketing leaders in the industry. And yeah, released it and it's been great.
Well, I want to talk to you about the interviews, but before I do, the one thing that kind of blew me away in the first three chapters, you got into really specific tools and procedures. It wasn't just so many I think internet marketing materials. You know, they give you advice or they say, you know, here, build a landing page, but they don't go into what that landing page should compose of. Or, you know, they say, you know, use Google Analytics and, you know, they kind of, you know, talk about, yeah, you should know your demographics and stuff, but you actually get down and saying, these are the demographics I saw when I ran, you know, Google Analytics against, you know, or ran this analysis against my competitors,
right,
and on my own stuff. Right.
Yeah, just, you know, and I think that all came from the type of content that draws me in is the stuff that's the most specific. So when I read other people's stuff and they're giving me their exact numbers and, you know, results of the tests they're running on themselves, I can take that abstract idea and comprehend it easier or know how to apply it to my own situation a little bit better. So, yeah, that was kind of a goal I had in writing it, is if I was going to say, there are a variety of tools out there that can help you do this, I'm not just going to stop there. I'm going to bullet list them. I'm going to say, here's this one, here's that one, here's this one. And one of the dangers with that is that the book, you know, then might become outdated in a few years because some of those tools might not still be around. But, you know, that's really not that hard to go back and update it. You know, every few years, just check on the handful of tools that I list off and just make sure that they're still running. If there's any new ones in the space, add those. You know, it's not really that big of a deal to keep the book up to date in terms of that, but I think that the direction and concrete examples is going to make the book a lot more valuable to somebody versus like, here's an idea, now figure out how to implement it. Actually giving them the link, like, go here, sign up, and, you know, that's your first step.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And you've gotten some incredible, interviews for bonus content. I was just kind of amazed of all the content you've included in the book, considering this is your first book. And it was just mind-blowing. I mean, you have Rob Walling of Drip. You have Hiten Shah of Kissmetrics, Andrew Culver of Churnbusters. And I really hope I'm pronouncing all those names right. how did you go about approaching? I mean, these are just a few that you have. But I looked at them. They were all, like, very successful. You know, bootstrappers, micro entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them. How did you go about approaching and convincing these really great people and very busy people and asking them to be interviewed?
Yeah, that was something that I was putting off for a long time because I was nervous about it. You know, I had even debated. I was like, you know, I'm just not going to include those bonus videos. You know, people just buy the book. Let's just... Actually, why don't I just sell it for, you know, $2.99 on Amazon as a Kindle book? You know, it's like, I was really tempted to, you know, just kind of go the easy route of, you know, not including all that bonus information because, you know, I was afraid of rejection. And I have to give all the props to Nathan Barry and his book Authority for this. He wrote a book, an ebook that actually you can now buy as a hardcover book on Amazon as well. But he outlined his process in writing two of his former books on designing web applications and designing mobile applications. So he had a lot of great advice, and he just said, you know, he had a bunch of interviews with some people that are busy and popular, and he said, yeah, I just, you know, I emailed them and I asked. He's like, don't give them don't offer compensation, because like one of the guys he had for one of his books was Jason Fried of 37 Signals, and it's like, no amount of money is going to convince Jay. I mean, I'm sure there is an amount, but, you know, it's like, I'm not going
to
be like,
you don't have
it. It's not like, hey, if I give you $300, will you give me some of your time? And, you know, like, I don't need $300. You know, if you would have just asked, maybe I would have.
Asking him, like, you know, hey, $300 for an interview would almost be insulting to him at a certain
exactly,
level.
Right. I had assembled a list of about 30 entrepreneurs that I, and just marketers that I wanted to reach out to. I made a spreadsheet. I wrote all their names down. And then next to each of their names, I put what I felt like they had to contribute to the conversation. So like Rob Walling, for example, he just released Drip, his email campaign tool. And well, he didn't just release it, but that's what he's focusing on. And it's a marketing automation tool. So I thought, you know, who better to talk about marketing automation than Rob Walling, you know, who has a tool that does it. And he, you know, he's done the research on it. So I'm sure he's the expert in that realm. So yeah. Then I hunted down everybody's email addresses. There were a few people whose email addresses I couldn't get. So I just friended them on LinkedIn and then sent them a message that way.
And was that pretty effective?
Well, of the couple people that I did that to, no, it wasn't.
Okay.
I think maybe there was a reason why they don't have their email address, you know, published anywhere. So,
yeah.
But I sent the same kind of request out to everybody, except I changed up the subject that I wanted to talk to them about. But it was like, hey, you know, I've got this book coming out. I'm looking to bundle some interviews with the book. I think that, you know, I'd love to talk to you about, you know, subject X. If you are interested, let me know and I'll keep the conversation to about 20 minutes and we'll do it via Skype. So just kind of giving them that expectation. And with Nathan's advice, he had said in the book, you know, like don't send them, you know, your schedule. Don't like give them all this information. Just start with like a small ask. Are you interested? And if they are interested, then say, okay, well, here's my schedule. Let's book something together. So, yeah, I got about 13 responses out of those that I sent out. Wow. So there was a handful that just ignored it. And that is to be expected, I guess. But yeah, the people who responded, you know, they were just willing to give their time. Super nice people, willing to help out other entrepreneurs. So I used a tool called Schedule Once at scheduleonce.com, where it ties in with my Google Calendar. So it shows everybody who clicks on a link what availability I have, and then they just check a box, which takes up one of those time slots. And then it fills in my calendar automatically, and it sends them an email reminder of the meeting. And it was just like perfect. It was just a great way to schedule all these. And so I scheduled them all within a period of 2 weeks. And wow. Yeah, it was a lot easier than I thought it would be. It just took a little bit of going forward and giving it a shot.
Yeah. Was there much editing that you had to do to the conversation once you finished recording?
There was a few. I mean, I had to do like an intro and an outro sequence, because after I like played the interviews, I just thought like, yeah, you need some music. It needs some intro.
Sure.
So, and then I did do some audio leveling and processing. I exported all the audio and learned a little bit about audio engineering, I guess, get rid of the hisses, the pops, you know, the background vents turning on, you know, various things. And then I put the audio back in and paired it up to our lips moving. There was only one interviewee who he like got a phone call in the middle of our interview and he had to take it. So he just like paused Skype and I just see him on the phone, you know, muted, just having a conversation. And then his laptop almost ran out of batteries. So then he had to like go find an adapter. And then plug it back in. So there was a lot of like going back through that one. And you know, so if you watch any of the videos and you see one that has a few like fade transitions in the middle of it, I tried to make them subtle, but there were a few spots we had to cut out.
Well, I like how you just dove in and you approached it very systematically. I mean, you made a plan first of like what you were, you know, what each person could talk about, and you just didn't leave it open ended of like, hey, you know, please, you know, can I interview you for my book? And I mean, you made it very specific of like, hey, Rob Walling, like, I would love if you talked about marketing automation.
Right.
And it's clearly something he's passionate about and he really lives, eats and breathes it every day. So, you know, and for 20 minutes, yeah, I mean, that's not a huge time commitment.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like that was twofold in getting those subjects down. I felt on one hand that I was letting them know, like, I'm not going to be throwing all these like surprise questions at you. Like, you know, you know, tell me about your, you know, relationship with so-and-so, you know, it's like nothing scandalous. It's going to be on the thing that they love to talk about. So it's going to be an easy interview. And in some cases, you know, the people behind it, they had applications that did what they would be talking about. So with Laura Roeder, I talked to her about Edgar, which is a social media automation tool. And I told her I wanted to talk about social media automation. So she came on and she was able to share a lot of what she's learned and why she built Edgar, her tool. And of course, like, then it's also in a way promoting Edgar. So it's a win-win for both of us in that sense.
Very cool. What are some of the biggest mistakes? You know, you wrote SaaS Marketing Essentials. I think it's a great book. And I think a lot of first time builders of SaaS products, especially, micro entrepreneurs or bootstrappers, you know, we go in as designers or developers and not necessarily as marketers. What are some of the biggest marketing mistakes you see first time entrepreneurs make? And like, what are some of those mistakes that your book is trying to resolve?
Yeah. And I've been guilty of this too. So, I mean, maybe I can speak the most of the mistakes that I've made in the past, and maybe, you know, I've heard other people make too, but it's being so close to the technology or so close to the idea that it becomes the focus. And one thing that I've learned over the years is that successful products, they're laser focused on an audience and an audience's problems. And sometimes those problems aren't exactly what you thought they would be, or the solution needs to be a little bit different. But in the end, the audience stays the same. You know, it's really easy to, or it's easier to pivot your product when it's still serving the same audience. It's just a little bit of a better implementation versus a product maybe that, you know, someone in search of an audience to buy this thing. You know, I built this app and I can't find anybody to buy it. Well, it's easy to focus on your product first and not your audience first. When building. So one of the things that my book really drives home is, you know, focusing on the audience, getting to know more about them, because then that will shape the foundation of all your marketing efforts, all the copy that you have within the app and the marketing site, and just, you know, what you might even name or title the app.
Yeah, because I think you had an example there about, you know, the word consultant and how, you know, it's used and it has different meanings,
right,
to different positions. So if you advertise, you know, at yourself as a consultant, you know, you may be sending the wrong message to your potential customers.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're really like an agency.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that came out of my own frustration, is everybody's like, you know, maybe I'll, you know, or people say, don't call me a freelancer, I'm a consultant. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. So, you know, who does the work then? And they're like, well, I do the work. And then it's like, well, I thought a consultant meant like you give advice, or you like kind of point towards somebody else to do the work. If you're doing the work yourself, then you are, you know, either an independent contractor or, you know, a freelancer, but you're not a consultant. And but it turns out that just within the field, the word consultant is actually just used. And when you say that I'm, you know, a web consultant, you know, a lot of times that might mean that you do also do the design and the development. So that's one of those examples where what you might think the definition of a word is, it might not be textbook, you know, and you won't know that until you dive into that industry and get to know how they're using terms and.
I had a funny anecdote when I first started dating my wife. She's a realtor. We would go out to realtor events and I would introduce myself as a developer.
Oh.
I'm not thinking any of it. And they'd be like, oh, well, what builder are you working with? And I'd be like, what? and they would like look at me and like, what? And I'd be like, oh, software developer.
Oh, yeah. Well, you should see the look on my family's faces when everybody is like, so your book launch, what's it called? And I'm like, SaaS Marketing Essentials. They're like, what? What's SaaS? And I'm like, software as a service. They're like, that still doesn't make any sense. So
yeah,
that I just say, it's a book on marketing your application, you know, like a web application. And then there's, you know, some of them still look at me funny and I'm like, You know, like an app on your phone, and they're like, yeah. And you're like, all right, kind of like that. I mean, even though it's nothing like that, it's like you just got to kind of dumb it down to, not dumb it down, but, you know, get it to associate with something that they are familiar with.
Yeah, yeah. Paradigm reframing.
Right.
So you're a big believer in, I guess, building a personal brand. And one of the sections in the book, you talked about your personal brand and, you know, how it fed into, you know, kind of what, in addition, you were doing with Harpoon and the book. What would you say to people who say that the time it takes to build a personal brand, a personal blog, takes away spent on developing the product or designing the product or, you know, doing, you know, client work or consulting work? What would you say to the importance of building a personal brand to those people who would say otherwise?
Well, I think a personal brand is just one traction channel of getting people to hear about your app. And it's not for everybody. I think it takes, you know, a certain personality type. You know, if you're the kind of person that enjoys, you know, like what we're doing right here, a podcast interview, you know, some people are super shy. They don't want to have, you know, interviews like this, or they don't want to put themselves out there on a blog. You know, if you're like going against the grain, and it's, you know, maybe there's another traction channel out there that will bring in better return for you. But for me, kind of being an extroverted person and not really having any issues with airing my laundry online, so to speak, or at least the business numbers of it all. You know, I just found that it was something that other people were doing, associating a personal brand with the products that they have. Like Noah Kagan wrote an article recently where he talked about how promoting his tool, AppSumo, and the other things that he's working on, the most powerful effect marketing efforts they have center around Noah promoting kind of his own brand versus like driving just the apps themselves. Pat Flynn is another example of somebody who's got an amazing personal brand. I mean, his personality is thrown into everything he does with his podcast and his books and his blog. And so it's like when Pat comes up with a new idea, he's got, you know, an army of people that are like ready to try it out and get excited about it. So I felt like building a personal brand is kind of like investing in a retirement plan in a way. It's something that, you know, beyond Harpoon, beyond any tool that I'm working on now, if people are interested in what I'm up to or find the stuff that I'm doing helpful, then, you know, if I want to launch another product, then I've got like a set of people that are ready to hear about it and give me their feedback. And so I can help tailor it faster to what, you know, people might be needing.
Well, fantastic. So if listeners of the podcast want to find more about you, where can they go?
Well, on Twitter, I'm Ryan Battles, all one word. And my website is ryanbattles.com. And for the listeners of this podcast, I have a special landing page set up at ryanbattles.com/flyover. If you go there, I'll give you a link to get the three free chapters of my book, as well as a coupon code to get a discount on the book. If you're interested after reading those chapters, if it sounds good, I'd love for you to have a copy.
All right, fantastic. Well, that's it for this episode of the Flyover Startups Podcast. If you or someone you know is an entrepreneur in a flyover state, let us know at contact@flyover.fm or on Twitter @flyoverfm. For more episodes, you can listen to us at flyover.fm, our website, or subscribe to us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.